Hi there, my name is Ted Baker. Normally I would say welcome, I'm glad to see you, but under the circumstances while we're meeting, maybe I'm not so glad to see you after all, and I realize that most of you would prefer not to be here, and that you're not in attendance at this particular session because you necessarily like me. But what I'm going to try to do today is I'm going to try to give you whatever suggestions I can and ideas that I'd like you to consider very much in terms of dealing with issues that contribute to academic difficulties. And the reason that I think that I could be helpful in that, in dealing with those kinds of particular issues, is because my role here at McGill is as director of the counseling service, and I have been doing that for 20 years. And certainly in that time period, I have dealt with a significant number of students who are experiencing academic difficulties. People come to the counseling service for a whole range of reasons. And they come there for a lot of the times for therapy, dealing with personal issues. But always attached to that, or very often attached to that, is academic things that are contributing to some of their other difficulties, or straightforward academic issues that are creating personal stress for them. So I've had a lot of experience looking at what is it that creates difficulties for students, academically and otherwise, and how can they address those particular issues, and what can they do that might be helpful to them to avoid those problems and to do what we assume, you and I and McGill, what we assume is what you're capable of doing, which is to enroll in a program of study, to enjoy the process, to graduate, and to get the heck out of here and become alumni who are happy with the process and who want to give money to McGill when somebody calls you up for a donation down the road. So everybody's kind of invested in that. You and I, and everybody's invested in your success. But things tend to get in the way. And what we have to do, and what I'm asking you to do, don't take everything that I have to say necessarily with a grain of salt, because I really don't have the magic bullet. I don't have an answer. And every time I work with somebody individually around things like that, it's always a matter of kind of piecing out what needs to be done, what needs to be looked at for them, what needs to be addressed, what needs to be put into place so that they, as a unique individual, can be successful. And so you have to kind of... I'm talking about this stuff right now globally because there's a large crowd of people here. I don't know what your individual circumstances are. So I want to kind of shotgun a lot of things that to share with you so that you can begin to think about it, because that's the solution to the problem that you're experiencing right now, that you have to sit down and you have to think and you have to answer a question, a particular question. And the question is, simply put, why are you here? And I don't mean sitting in this room, you know why you're here right now in this particular room. But why are you here in terms of the circumstances that you find yourself? Why are you here under conditions of difficulty? Because we know, and the assumption we have made, at least the school has made, admissions committee have made, is that you have been accepted to this place and you have been accepted to this faculty because you have the goods to be successful. You've done something in the past, you've got a record of sorts that says, here are smart kids, here are capable kids, here are kids who can do it. There is no real necessary intellectual difficulties that anybody who is here is going to have in coping with the academic requirements. So that's the assumption that people make. So it's always a bit of surprise to you and us as well, meaning McGill, when people do encounter difficulties. And then it becomes a question of, what the heck is going on? Why are you here? Why are these people, why are these particular students and all the other students around McGill who are experiencing the same kinds of difficulties, why is that happening to them? And if they can figure that out and they can put things in place, will it help them to overcome those difficulties so they can do what we assume they can do, which is to be successful? So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm going to look at throwing out some ideas to you that I want you to think about, I want you to consider, I want you not to necessarily reject outright, even if it seems a little bit unlikely that it is your particular problem. I want you to consider things so that you yourself may be able to devise the strategy that's necessary for you to be able to work your way through this. Now, the first thing that I'm going to talk about, and this is something, because when I do this with people individually, I see them squirm a little bit from time to time because they don't really often want to consider it. But the first thing I would throw out to you for consideration is, have you made the right choice of program? Should you be in this particular building? Because a lot of times, what we find out is that people are studying and doing things for one reason or another, but perhaps they shouldn't be. And some people make a move. Some people leave McGill and go to a different kind of university. Some change programs, get out of one faculty, go into another. So you really, what I want you to ask yourself is, should you be doing this? Because that might be issue number one. If you're having academic difficulty, is it because you're doing something that maybe you shouldn't be doing? And there's some kind of resistance to what you're doing going on somewhere, somehow, that is preventing you from being successful. We have a program over at the counseling service called the PACE program. And I'm going to flog this a little bit. We offer it to students about 10 times a year, 8 to 10 times a year, a couple of times for graduate students. And and we get lots of people coming in every time. So it's kind of makes us realize that people have these particular questions. And the question that is posed in PACE is, what should I be doing? What should I be studying? What kind of career should I have down the road? What's going to make me happy? And it's a 10-hour program, two and a half hours over 4 weeks, where people come in and they wrestle with those kinds of issues. And we give them a couple of tests that they take to help them determine career direction. And one of them is called the Myers-Briggs type test. It's about personality. And what we discover from the Myers-Briggs, it's a very well-researched instrument, and what we discover from it is that almost everybody in the world can be placed into 16 different types of person. And each one of those particular types has different strengths and weaknesses. And some types are very closely aligned and similar, and some are very different from one another. And what they have done is they've made the connection between type and success in careers. And they have found that certain types gravitate towards certain careers. And if the type and the career matches, then it's they're generally a very high rate of success and satisfaction for the individual and in terms of the career. But if you get a type that is unlike the career, there's some kind of difference between what's required in the career and what's necessary and the personality of the individual, there's difficulty and conflict. And that doesn't mean people can't do it, because you, I know, and I'm assuming that are very bright people. So we get bright people who come to McGill who can do things that they want to do because they're bright. We have a lot of people in medical school who are bright. We have a lot of people in law school who are bright. They can do it. But very many of them struggle in it, not because they're not bright enough to do it, but because it's not for them. It's not satisfying, it's not motivating, it's not using their strengths and their talents to the best of their ability. So we get a lot of doctors who don't want to, not a lot, but we get a significant number who get into a career and they don't really want to be a doctor. Or we get a lawyer who graduates from law school who doesn't really practice law, simply because that's not what they should be doing with their life. And very often that leads to having a population that are in certain careers where they're functioning, but they're not succeeding in the sense that they're not motivated, they're looking, you know, you're 22 years old and you're looking to retire. That's not a good place to be in terms of career development. So what I'm suggesting is the first thing that you have to do is whether you've come here, you've had an idea that this is where you should go and this is where you belong, but I want you to just question that particular personal assumption in case that's the problem. Because people go into things for a lot of different reasons. And sometimes people go into a course of action, an academic course of action, and a career even, because there's some other influence. They ignore the self. They ignore what they really, who and what they really may be, and they go into something because there's jobs available when you graduate, or there's prestige attached, or Aunt Sally is a lawyer, so I'm going to be a lawyer. Or Daddy's pressuring me to go into this because other careers are not acceptable. So people have these outside influences working on them, and then they go, they're in high school or CJEP or something, and they're pretty good in this or that, or they're good in writing papers, or they're good in math, and they say, well, what the heck am I going to do with this particular thing? I think I'll do this because I can. And they end up enrolling in engineering, or they end up enrolling in science or law or anything else, and all of a sudden they're not performing the way they expect to. They're not doing what they thought they could do, and they become unhappy, and there's a downward spiral. And pretty soon we have people who are really struggling who should not be struggling under normal assumptions about being in the right place and doing the right thing. So the first thing I would ask you to consider carefully and not reject it too quickly is whether or not you belong in this particular pond. Because if you don't, and you stay, you may have to be willing to continue to struggle. Because you're going to be competing with people who can swim in this pool without a problem. You're going to have people who are very bright, who belong here, who are going to sail through. There are people who graduate from this faculty with 4.0 CGPAs, because that's what they do and that's what they like. And they don't have a problem with it. They put in the work and they get the results. So if you're competing against them and it's not the right thing for you to do, even though you're bright, you may struggle. And then you get into a career down the road, and the struggle continues, because now you are competing in a workplace against these people who are naturals, who belong there. And so they're getting promoted and you're not, because your work may not be up to theirs. Your interest may not be as high as theirs. What you produce may not be as good as theirs, simply because you don't belong in the pond. So that is the first question that I would ask you to consider. Give that some thought. And if you work your way through that, and some of you will, maybe most of you, maybe all of you, work your way through that question and say, yes, I've thought about it, I've considered my options, I've looked carefully, that is not the problem. I am the fish in the right pond. It's something else. The question of why I am here, meaning why am I in these circumstances, is something other than career choice. So you can check that off at least and say, now I'm left with the question of what else could it be? And you're narrowing it down. So that's number one. Just to remind you, if you are interested in doing the PACE program, if you think about this and you decide, well, maybe there is something I ought to be doing, maybe there's something I'll be more academically successful in or happy in or happier in or whatever, because there are many hundreds and thousands of careers that people can consider using the kinds of talents that you may have, what you want to do is take a look this semester or next semester, and again, I'm assuming you're going to be here next semester, and I want you to look at the schedule for PACE, and if you can, commit yourself to going through that program, devoting that 10 hours, just to see if you can learn something about it. You will learn about yourself, you will learn about other career opportunities, you will learn what the possibilities are for people who are of your type and the ponds that you could swim in. So that's number one, flogging the counseling service. Way, way, way on the other side of campus where you never get is, well, you might get there because the student union is over there, but we're in the Brown Building on the corner of McTavish there next to the student union. So that's number one. The second thing that I think is very, very important, excuse me for a second. The next thing that I think is very important, and I've learned this not only through my own process of going through many years of graduate school, but in working with graduate students. A lot of the work we do with the counseling services with graduate students, because they have a particular large set of difficulties that they have to cope with. One of the things that I learned from graduate students around being successful academically is simple organization. An organization begins with this large umbrella called time management. You have to learn how to use time well at McGill in order to be successful. And the most successful students, and particularly grad students, tend to be very excellent time managers, very excellent organizers, because time becomes precious and they have to use it effectively. So what I have learned in my work with undergraduate students, particularly new students, is that they tend, for the most part, to be fairly poor time managers. They don't use time well. They've got these old habits from the past, from high school or CGEP or wherever they come from. They haven't had to be time managers because they've been able to get through what's demanded of them fairly easily. I saw my son in high school. He was the world's biggest slacker. You know, he waited. He was a procrastinator. He did things at the last minute. He didn't worry. He studied for tests the night before. I'm sweating like a dog, and he's having a great time playing on the computer. But he didn't have to worry about it because he could always pull it off. In high school, you know, you read 20 pages and you regurgitate a few things, and you whip it. It's not that difficult in many cases to get through with fairly decent marks. Then you move on to a higher level, and all of a sudden you can't pull it off quite so easily. There's a heck of a lot more work. There's a heck of a lot more demands. The bar has been raised in terms of what level you have to work at, and all of a sudden people can't do the kinds of things they've done before and get away with it. They have to become efficient, and they have to become good time managers. So this is my suggestion to you. And a lot of people reject this suggestion and say, oh, I don't have to do this. But it can be helpful to some of you who are not efficient and organized at this point in your academic careers. The first thing I want you to do is look at the big picture in terms of time management, which means you want to make an investment, if you can, in one of those big desk calendars. Okay, I have one on my desk over in the Brown Building. And on that desk calendar, I have everything marked practically through the whole semester that I have to stay aware of. So I know coming up next week, and I know what's coming up 3 weeks, and I know what's coming up at the end of the term in terms of things that I have to get done, reports I have to write, and meetings, and all things. It's all set out there, so I'm always aware. I'm going through that calendar every couple of days, looking at what's coming up, seeing if I'm on track for the things that are planned down the road. I'm doing that, looking at the big picture. So I recommend that you get one of those calendars if you don't already have one, and you mark everything for the semester that you need to be aware of and reminded of on that calendar. When is this due? When is this exam? How am I going to be ready for that particular point in time, whatever it happens to be? So you can't forget things, you can't hide in denial, you can't say, oh, how did I not get ready for that? You won't spend the night before an exam cramming. One of the things I hate is when students have to spend the last night before an exam cramming. That should not be, and good time managers never have to study a lot the night before an exam. It's not necessary if you're managing your time very well. So you do that. That's it. Hold on to the big picture. Understand where your responsibilities are. And then you get a day planner. Okay? Inside my bag, I have my day planner. And inside that day planner, I know what's going on this week. And I know what's going on today. So that not only do I have the big picture, but I have the picture for the week and I have the picture for the day, so that nothing can escape my observation. So if you haven't done that, if you're haphazard, as most students are, which means you say, I'll put in a couple hours studying tonight, or you know, if I get out of the bar on time, I'll try to do my laundry, or whatever the hell people say to themselves, haphazard, you know, maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't happen. That kind of a lack of focus and concentration is what gets people into trouble and lowers their efficiency. So you want to know day by day what you're going to be responsible for, what you're trying to accomplish, so that you give yourself every opportunity to do that. Now, I did a little calculation for fun here, and what I found is that when you look at a week, and a lot of students say, geez, there's not enough time for stuff. You know, I don't have enough time to do everything I need to get done, and at the end of term, you know, the counseling service is just packed with sweaty bodies of students who are coming in because they've got too much to handle, and the mountain's too big, and they're breaking down, and they can't cope because all this stuff is all of a sudden avalanched on them because they haven't been efficient in through the rest of the term, and all of a sudden at the end, all these demands are falling on their shoulders, and they simply can't cope with it, understandably. And so they go into panic, or they ask for letters to defer exams, all sorts of troublesome kind of things that are unnecessary, but happen dozens and dozens of students every semester. I did a little calculation about time, and I discovered, if you do the multiplication, that there are 168 hours in a week. If you sleep 56 of those hours, which is a fair amount to sleep, you are left with 114 hours divided by the 7 days, and you've got 16-hour days. So sleep aside, you've got 16-hour days. That seems like a fair amount of time to be able to work with. 16 hours a day that you are free to do whatever you want with, other than sleep. That's the time. And then people say, I don't have enough time to do anything. Well, the question then becomes, what are you doing with the 16 hours that you have to give yourself, and how are you using it so that you do or do not have enough time to make it reasonable? My feeling is that a successful student really has to consider school as a job. I know you guys are here to learn how to get a job, and you are here, some of you, to avoid having a job. Not a bad idea at your age. But school needs to be looked at as a job, because that is your job. That's what I kept telling my kid. I said, look, what are you telling me here? School is your job, and most jobs demand more than 30 minutes a day. That was what he wanted to do in high school. He figured 30 minutes a day was enough. And unfortunately it was. Although now it's rougher. So if school is your job, you have to say, what am I willing to work? If you're going to go out and be an engineer, nobody's going to let you fart around a couple of hours a day. They're going to demand, at least 8 hours, maybe 9, 10 perhaps hours of your time in exchange for money. And they're going to expect you to do the job. They're not going to be interested whether you're tired in the morning, and they're not going to be interested whether you've got something else to do, or whether you've got a date with somebody you like. They don't care. They just want you to be there to do your job. 35, 40, 45, 50 hours a week. That's what you're preparing yourself for, and I see no reason why you shouldn't be starting to look at that now. Graduate students treat school as a job. They work at it. Sometimes the guys are in the lab 8 o'clock in the morning and they leave 8 o'clock at night. And the rest of the time, they're working because that's their job. They want to get that degree. They want to get the heck out of here. They want to start earning money. They're putting in the time now. They've invested in themselves. They don't want to throw it away. So they treat it as a job. I suggest that your job is an easy one. Because I think you could all be excellent students if you were organized, if you didn't have any external problems to deal with, which we'll talk about later. But if you were organized and focused and a good time manager, and you put in a 35-hour week on your job, which is not excessive, that's 7 hours a day, 7 out of your 16 hours, would be devoted to your job, which is school-related work. Going to class, taking notes, reviewing stuff, doing labs, whatever it happens to be, if you are devoting conscientiously, that's 7 hours a day, that 35 hours a week, which I think can make you an A student, if you're in the right pond, if you are working 7 hours a day, 35 hours a week, not only would you be a successful student, but you would have all your evenings off, and you would not have to do anything on the weekend. Because that's what most people do on their job. They work from 9 to 5, they go home, and they relax. And they have the weekends off. And they put in their 40 hours. If I put in a 40-hour week, I'm here at 9 o'clock in the morning, I leave at 5. If I put in a 40-hour week, I got lots of time left over in the evening and on weekends to do sweet bugger all. And you would too. But if you're not a good time manager, if you're putting in 20 minutes on a Monday and an hour on Tuesday, you don't have a 35-hour week. And then you're scrambling on the weekend to make up, to do all these assignments, to do this study, to get to the library, to read things. But you don't want to do it on the weekend because you got a date with your friend, or you want to go and have a beer, or you want to get on the internet and spend a few more hours shooting people or whatever the heck you do on Facebook. Technologically not so hot. But that becomes a reality. So I want you to think, how the heck can I do that? I want you to consider that. Am I treating school as a job? Am I serious about it? If you've come here, and I don't expect you simply to be some kind of dweeb that does nothing but work. That's not real. I think you have to do more than that. You have to really balance your life. But why are you here? You're here to do a job. Nobody is paying you at the end of the week in a paycheck, which is what motivates a lot of people when they have a job. But you are getting paid nevertheless. You are getting paid with a future career, a future paycheck. You know, a degree is going to be worth a lot of money in your pocket over the course of 30 or 40 years in the job market. So you will get paid, but it's simply that you have to delay that gratification and you have to take the rewards another way, the rewards of feeling satisfaction in the work that you do, getting, you know, decent grades that you don't have to worry about. But the way you have to do it is to think seriously about whether you've got it in you, whether you want to treat it in a way that you're going to make it a job and you're going to devote the time to it. And if you're not, because there are people here, I know for sure, because I talk to them, who spend most of their time doing other things than school. They like to go out. They like to be with their friends. They like to smoke up a little bit. They like to have a beer or five. Now, I heard, there's rumors over on the other side of campus about engineers. You know, party guys and girls. Hard partiers, know how to play. The question is, do you also know how to work? That becomes essential. That balance between those two things becomes critical. And if not being efficient, if not being organized, if not managing your time, if not putting in the hours means that you have to be in this room with me today, I think you have to think about it. Because you don't want to be here. And it may be that you have to change that structure. You have to become more efficient and organized in order to do that. At least give it a try and see what happens. The other thing that I would suggest very much for you is while you are doing your job, which is school-related work, try to be efficient. I sit down with people sometimes and I ask them to make me a study schedule. And they come in and often it's like, it's a bit excessive. They become highly motivated, they got this New Year's resolution kind of attitude. They come in with these schedules that seem, for me, not really viable. Because they've piled too many hours, generally, together. I had one guy come in last year, and he was going to work like 8 hours in a row, like on a Saturday. And I said, it's not going to happen. You can't do it. Your efficiency is going to go right off a cliff, and you might put the 8 hours in, sitting at your desk, but you are not going to get very much return from that. One of the things I do, it's kind of a sadistic thing, no, I wouldn't use sadistic, that's too much of a negative word, but it's kind of an amusing thing I do is, during exam period, I go down to the library, the undergrad library, just to walk around and watch people suffer, studying for their exams, because I don't have to do it anymore. Maybe that is sadistic. But I go down and I look at people studying, and sometimes it amuses me a little bit because I see such gross inefficiency. I see students sitting at the desk, and their kind of eyes are glazed over, you could do this, they would move their heads on the book, hoping that somehow osmosis gets the material into their brain while they're snoozing, or they're down at the, Tim Hortons is just packed with people having coffee and chit-chatting and all the study carols are empty upstairs. Efficiency is critical when you're doing your job. When you're out in the real world, not only are you expected to put in your hours, but you're expected to put in your hours in a productive way, in an efficient way. So you have to find your own means and level of maintaining your efficiency. And it may be different for everybody, but one of the things we know is that if you've got a block of time that you're going to devote to your job, whether you're reviewing your notes or whether you're studying or whether you're working on some kind of assignment, your efficiency can only remain high for maybe an hour. They often say 45 minutes. Some people can go as long as a couple of hours at pretty high efficiency, depending on the nature of the work and depending on how much they're engrossed in the work and how much they enjoy the work. Sometimes you can't keep up your level of efficiency because the work is difficult or challenging for you, and so you need to back away from things in half an hour or so and take some kind of a break or move to something else so that your level of efficiency can stay as close to 100% as you possibly can. It's not how many hours you put in, but how many hours you put in at a high level of efficiency that counts. So there are people who can work 20 hours a week at a high level of efficiency who will get more done, be more productive and more successful than somebody else who puts in 40 hours a week at a very low level of productivity. And there are all sorts of things that you can learn about yourself and try it out to see how do I function best. How long can I go doing something and really getting the most out of it? The other thing you have to look at is the character, your own personal characteristics. A guy comes in to me and he's got this study schedule for the morning. He shows me, oh yeah, I'm going to be able to put in 3 hours on Thursday morning. I have no classes. But he's not a morning person. It takes him like 45 minutes to get his feet off the bed. Another 25 minutes for a cup of coffee. Then he's got to read the newspaper. He's just working on half speed in the morning. So for him to try and put in a big load of study time when he's not ready for it, when his biology just doesn't allow it, is a tremendous time waster. He was a night owl. Getting him to work at night, you know, from 10 to 1 in the morning, he could be blitzing along at 95% efficiency, whereas he might get 40% efficiency by trying to work in the morning. So we had to fool around with his schedule to try and put in things that would allow him to be productive in a way that worked for him. So I ask you again, suggest, look at a schedule. Look at that master sheet, look at your daily schedule and say, how much time, where am I going to fit in my job, where am I going to fit in my 35 hours, what am I going to do with that time? There might be a time where you just want to read over material, and there might be another time when you're going to try to really understand concepts, you're really going to try to get that mastery of that material, but you may have to do it at a time that's going to allow you to do that, not when you're tired, not when you've had a couple of beers. Not early in the morning if you've been out till 3 o'clock. That doesn't work. It's almost like you're deceiving yourself to think that you can be successful, but people do that a lot of the time. So think about that, working at high efficiency. Remember, you need to start now. I say this, I do an introductory speech at the beginning of the year to incoming frosh, and one of the things I talk about, and I would again repeat that to you here, is that often students who have difficulty approach the semester in the wrong way. What they do is they come in September and they see the whole semester ahead of them. And they see the green grass and they see the sunshine of September. And they go into the term in slow motion. You know, the first week of school is just meeting people on frosh week and finding out which is the best beer and where the toilets are and all that important stuff. And then as it comes week two, you know, 2.5 weeks go by, oh shit, I better buy my books, you know. Things are kind of going along pretty slowly. And all of a sudden they discover they're on a hill that slants like this. And all of a sudden it's midterms, you know, they got their first midterms back and oh shit, you know, B-, I gotta worry about this a little bit. And then the end of the term all of a sudden sneaks up on them because, remember, ladies and gentlemen, it's a 13-week term here. It's not half a year. Oh, I've been going to school for half a year. No, you're going to school for 13 weeks, which is essentially 3 months, and the semester finito. So you've got to remember, it goes by pretty damn fast. And what we recommend to people is that they tackle the semester in the opposite of what normally happens. In other words, you run like hell at the beginning of the term, you work like a dog, you stay up on anything, you sacrifice as much as you have to put the hours into your job so that you can coast at the end Because what happens at the end? At the end of every term, people are trying to stay up with the work that keeps coming in. They're very fatigued and tired. They're running out of gas. You know, you guys are all beautiful, new, shiny automobiles on the road of life. I'm kind of like slowing down here. But you guys are beautiful, shiny automobiles, but you too can run out of gas. And most of you do by the end of term. You're not all peppy and happy at the end of term. You're running out of gas. And so when you need the most time and energy, that's when you can't get it. That's when you're most stressed. That's when you're most fatigued. So that's when you're staying up all night, trying to study for an important exam by cramming all night and doing yourself a disservice because you haven't pushed the pedal to the metal at the beginning of the term and coasted towards the end. I had a friend of mine, a little aside, when I was an undergraduate, I hated the guy, loved him, but I hated him. Because he was Mr. Efficiency. His name was Marvin. We called him Marvelous Marv. Because he just had a natural instinct for doing things right. And so he would be a very conscientious guy and very efficient time manager, and the rest of us were there playing poker in the old way, with cards on the table, you know, all on the computer screen. We'd be playing poker 2 o'clock in the morning. He'd be finishing off his assignments. Come the end of the term, we're all sweating bullets. Oh my God, 3 exams, paper coming up. And how am I going to do it? Pulling our hair out. Marv, the night before every exam, he would go out. Loved to go to the movies the night before an exam. It relaxed him, he said. Relaxed him. He had done all his work. He'd done all his review. He was ready for the test. He thought of it as an interesting challenge because he was going to have an opportunity to show those buggers what he knew. And he did. He was a very excellent student. But he had prepared himself all the way along, and he relaxed when he had to run. He went to bed early the night before an exam and ready to go. And he always did well. So the rest of us hated him. One day, we were living in a rest. One day he went out to his movie. We all got together. We took everything we owed and we put it in the bathroom. Everything. His room was empty. The bathroom was filled. Had to get him back. Mark comes in, sees his room is empty, says, oh hell. Went, slept in somebody else's room, got up the next day, aced his exam. That was the kind of guy he was. No panic, no last minute kind of turmoil. He just knew to handle things and he was an excellent student. Graduated with great distinction. One of the things, so what I want you to remind you of is from this point on, you have about 11 weeks in this semester. You got about 4 weeks before the study break, you got a 1 week study break, and then you got 6 weeks after the break and you're into exams. So you're down to 11 weeks, including a study break. And I want you to remember those words, study break. Study break. Say them to yourself. Study break. Not ski break. Not sunshine break. Study break. Which means that it gives you an opportunity to use your time management and your efficiency. If you are behind in your work, when you arrive at study break, don't go down to the sunshine. Use the time to catch up. If you are up to date on the study break, don't go skiing for 7 solid days. Go for 2 days, 2.5. Come back, catch, get ahead of your work for the last 6 weeks. That is what your job demands of you. You guys should be able to go more than 13 weeks without falling apart and demanding a sunshine break or a ski break. You should be able to do it if necessary. If you have a 4.0 average, hey, be my guest. Go lie on the beach, relax, call Marvelous Marv, get together. But if you don't, if you're struggling with a particular subject, if you're struggling overall, if you need to work to make sure that you're going to be successful, you have to be willing to make some of those sacrifices. Hello. One of the things that gets in the way of people being successful, students, particularly new students, is something called procrastination. Procrastination is the devil of success. It's going to grab you and hurl you around if you are not careful. There may be a lot of different reasons for procrastination. Sometimes procrastination springs up because people are dealing with our anxiety. Procrastination allows us to back away from our anxiety. When you have to make a decision about sitting down and doing work, or watching TV for another half hour, or staying up, checking your email for the 50th time today, if you do that, it's often because you are feeling anxious about approaching the work that you have to do for whatever reason, and you are backing away from the work by procrastinating. So you get the immediate relief of not having to confront whatever is stressing you about doing the work, but the procrastination is there like a ball rolling down a hill, a snowball getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and finally if you procrastinate long enough, it crushes you, because you ultimately will have too much to do in too little time. Sometimes procrastination works for people. I'm not saying you can never procrastinate, but sometimes people need to be wound up before they can be efficient. So sometimes people procrastinate a little bit, it winds them up tightly, and then all of a sudden they explode and they do an amazing amount of work in a very short period of time. It's not a bad strategy if it works. The problem is it too often fails. Because when the time comes for the explosion of work, i.e. the end of the term, because you haven't been doing your 7 hours a day through the rest of the term, and then you have to explode to get things done, sometimes it fails because the unexpected happens. You come down with the flu, a bus runs over your foot, you fall on the ice and break an ankle, your girlfriend decides she likes your best friend better than you. A lot of things can happen to throw a monkey wrench into the plan to explode at the end of the term in a frenzy of energy. And the other thing that can happen is that there's just too much to do. You explode, but you got far too much to do in that time that you've allowed yourself. And then stress hits hard and heavy, and you begin to panic, and your efficiency drops down to zero, and you can't get anything done. So think about that. The other thing to do is to check your study skills. You may have skills that got you here. They may not be ones that are going to allow you to stay here. How do you work? How do you approach your work? Do you need to do it differently than you're doing it now? There are a vast number of ways of approaching studying. It's not one. You may have your set way of doing it, and it may have been effective, but again, if it's failing you, check into it. Look at how you might be able to do it differently. Do you study when you plan to study? Do you study when you're efficient? Do you read actively? Do you know how to read actively, for example? That's one of the study skill tools, is active reading, not passive reading where your eyes just run down a page or you're highlighting everything in yellow. Sometimes you see textbooks that go from white to yellow. I don't understand what that's supposed to do, but that's how people do. They pass their pen along the page, filling it in, hoping that somehow, again, that they're going to not have to go back to that material. Do you take good notes? Do you take good lecture notes? Do you take good notes from your material? Are you concise? So when you go back to study it, you're not starting from square one. You've got a 100 pages condensed into 5. So that you never have to go back to the 100. You've got the 5, and that contains everything you need to make your to be able to produce effectively on any examination that's given to you. Do you spend time reviewing? Remember, one of the rules of good learning is review. There's a thing called the curve of forgetting. And if you study something and then you don't go back to it, it just keeps dropping off of the curve of forgetting until about 15 days later, you really know about 15% of what you started off knowing. But if you go back to things and you review things, the second time the material comes more quickly, the third time it comes quicker than that, the fourth time it's there, locked into your understanding, your knowledge, your short and long-term memory, and you can access it 20 years down the road. But it only comes from going back to things and reviewing it, not doing it once and then forgetting it, or saying, I don't have time to come back to this. And that's why good notes are very important, because you can go back and review your notes. You don't have to go back to the original source, or even the textbook, or you have examples that just
When you see them, it makes you understand how to operate. There's all sorts of different techniques and ways that you can approach how you study. So you have to individually take a look at what you're doing, why it may not have been working for you to date, what's available to you. The web is filled with different ideas and dozens and dozens of topics around study skills. And you may have to look and say, what can I incorporate, what can I do, what can I use that's going to be effective for me? And then if you have to change, it's like a golfer, you know, all those professional golfers, something goes wrong, sometimes they have to, it's very hard, but sometimes they have to learn to change that swing. They have to learn how to change the way they stand, or their game goes down the tubes. But if they're able to make those changes, then they can get back on track again. So I want you to consider that and look at that. Is that your particular problem? Do you ask questions? Are you bold enough to make sure that you understand things so that you go and you ask professors questions, you ask TAs questions, you ask your classmates questions? Don't let anything get by you. If you don't understand something, don't say, well, tomorrow I'll look into this, but right now I'm going to have a little weed so I can relax. No. You take that piece of paper with the question, you find the answer to that before you settle down. Then you have it. Do you need tutoring? You have tutors here in engineering. We have tutors over in student services. Our tutors cost $15 an hour. But say five hours of tutoring is going to get you over a hump. It's going to get you through a hard class. It's going to teach you something that you're not really grasping. That's a well-invested $75. You have to give up a little bit of beer. Maybe a pizza or two. But you're going to get that help. And here is the good news, ladies and gentlemen. I do have some good news for you. The counseling service is giving to students on probation free tutoring. So it doesn't cost you $15 an hour. It costs you $0 an hour. It's not unlimited, mind you, but if you went to the counseling service to look for a tutor and we could find one for you, then it would be subsidized. It would be free. Because again, we're invested in your success. We really want you to be able to deal with things and to be successful and happy alumni when you graduate. Only a couple more things, then we'll be done. One of the things you need to do is control your stress. Stress is murder. If you are a person prone to stress, if you get anxious, if you get nervous, if that anxiety prevents you from being efficient, if it prevents you from doing your job and putting in your 35 hours, if it's making you run away into diversions and entertainments, deal with your stress. There are ways of mastering stress. We're giving about 15 workshops this term over in the counseling service, and three of them are on meditation-based stress control. And they'll teach you things to do to help you with stress. Because when people are not stressed, they're much more productive, they're much more efficient. And stress is a killer, particularly when you're in a tight, kind of a tight spot where you guys are, where there's really a lot of pressure on you to get going here and to see what the difficulties are and overcome those difficulties. That creates stress in itself. And stress can really burn people up. It can wear them out. And if you're under constant stress, and school itself is a stress, it's a 13-week stress. It's not like it's 2 days and then it stops. The whole term is stressful, as many jobs are. And so sometimes if people are highly stressed, they're burnt out by the end of it. And if you're burnt out at the end of term because of your stress, it becomes very difficult to do well in your final preparations for your examinations. Then you have to deal with test anxiety. A lot of people do well, they study, they're efficient, they know a lot, and then they fall apart on the exam for whatever reason. They just, you know, there are people who... There are people every term who have to leave the exam room because they can't do it. They're too anxious. They have a panic attack. They start hyperventilating. And they may be sitting at the desk in an exam room, or they may be at the door of an exam room, and they have to be taken away. They can't write their exam. Because test anxiety, that particular moment, creates too much pressure for them. So if you are prone to test anxiety, and you've had anxiety in this past set of exams that you've had, and you're worried about anxiety compromising your performance in the future, deal with it. Don't ignore it. Find out. There are ways, there are cognitive ways, there are physical ways of dealing with stress and test anxiety that may be helpful to you. You've got to put them, make them part of the tools that you use in order to do your job effectively. And then finally, those are academic skills. There are also personal issues that may be creating problems for you. I'll just read them off instead of going over them. Again, generalized anxiety, not specific anxiety, but generalized anxiety related to the fear of failure and the implications of that. Or perfectionism. Perfectionism gets in the way of a lot of students because they cannot allow themselves to be imperfect, and the attempt to be perfect creates an enormous amount of pressure on them. And just one more quick aside, there was a girl from engineering, as a matter of fact, quite a number of years ago, who was going into her final semester with a 4.0. Okay, she had got perfect all the way through. And she came to see me because she was having panic attacks. And she was hyperventilating, she was feeling faint a lot of the time. And she was, her head was swimming around. And so when I asked her, you know, what's going on, it turns out that what she was afraid of and why she was thinking that she would not be able to write her final set of exams was because she wasn't going to get a 4.0 on that last set of exams. It was not conceivable to her that she would get a 3.95 for anything. She had to graduate with that 4.0. She was a perfectionist to the nth degree. And that, as she got closer to that goal, the pressure got more and more on her to maintain that, and at the end she began to fall apart, simply because anything else was, anything below 4.0 was a failure in her mind. So we have to look at things like that. We have to look at perfectionism, we have to look at how you deal with competition. Competition can sometimes get in the way for people. And how do you deal with that sense of competition that allows you to minimize the kind of pressure you respond to? Finally, I've been saying a lot about doing your job and working hard and being efficient, but I really think that what you have to do is you have to find out in your own way how to keep your life in balance. One of the things that students do at the end of the term is they give up everything that sustains them. If they've been going out with friends, or they've got a relationship, or they like to sleep in, they give it all up under the stress, under the pressure of having to get a lot done and exams coming up. They don't sleep well, they don't eat well, they stop exercising, they cut out all their social activities, they hibernate and try to focus simply on what they're doing, and it works against them. You need to keep your life in balance. And that's why I say, if you put in a 35-hour week, you've still got 9 hours every day for yourself after you put in your 7 hours of work. You still have 9 hours to play with them. You should use those 9 hours to create that balance, to have a good time, to have a glass of beer, to go on a date, to talk to your friends, to get on the computer. All of that in moderation and in balance is what's going to really sustain you. So, the goals, simply put, right down here. These are the goals that you should focus on and have for yourself. Improve any deficient skills that you might have academically. Think about it, realize it, tackle it, find a solution to those skills, improve those skills to give you every opportunity to do well from an academic skill level. Manage your time and work efficiently. Don't waste time. Put the time aside to work, and while you're working, get a lot done. Get it done efficiently. Work through any personal issues you have. If you're dealing with anxiety, if you're dealing with depression, if you're dealing with a broken romance, and here's a suggestion for you. Every year, people are couples, and the relationship chooses, for some odd reason, to break off right before exams. And people come in with broken hearts the week before exams, unable to function.
So my word of advice to you is, if you're in a relationship and there's any hint at all that it's not going to last, hang on to it till after exams. It's only a couple of more weeks. Pretend if you have to. But get through exams before you break up. And then all the tears don't matter. And the guilt, if you're the one making the tears. And live a balanced life. Those are the four cardinal rules I would suggest. And now, in that little package that I've given you, I'm going to tell you to take this home with you and think about it. I've just written down on that sheet some questions I want you to consider carefully. If you answer these questions true, untrue, or maybe. And if you've got any untrues or you've got any maybes, think about what you can do about it. And maybe if you have to, add your own questions, because there's only 15, there may be more questions. There may be other ones you want to add to that list, but if it's untrue, or maybe, don't let it lie, don't ignore it, take care of it, and if you do that, I'm guessing that you will not be back in this room again next semester. Thank you, everyone.
Before you go, one more minute. We want to thank Dr. Baker for coming today. This is the first of a series of many workshops we're hoping to offer you. He's a very busy guy, and if any of you ever try to get in front with him, you can wait in line. But thank you very much, Dr. Baker.
One more thing. It is busy, and I'm hard to get a hold of, but I want you to know this, because I am invested in you guys. If you have any questions specifically that you think I can help you with, email me, ted.baker@mcgill.ca, first name, last name, @mcgill.ca. If you email me with a question, I will get back to you and give you whatever help and guidance I can, okay?
Okay, and just in closing, thank you for all coming. This is a really great turnout. I think it was really effective. Some of the messages that were given today, I think I can take home myself personally. I think it will help me in my work life. We are there. You know that my name is Judy Farrell. I'm the Associate Director of the Engineering Student Center, and it's Leslie Morin and Susie Vodopivic. We're available in the Student Affairs Office. We want to see all of you, okay? At one point in the next couple of weeks, drop in. Our role here is to ensure that you succeed, okay? We're here, we're committed to you, so please come and see us. If we can help you, we will help you follow through some of the assistance that you're going to need with. To end up walking down the aisle and graduating and getting your degree in engineering. Okay? So again, come and see us down the hall, the Student Center.
Has everybody signed the, or kicked off the name?